Now, COVID-19 has done a lot of economic damage alongside the widespread risks to health. Our next guest says that the economic fallout has pushed us to the edge of a housing crisis, making an existing problem even worse. Even before COVID-19, housing costs were eating up a big portion of people's budgets. For homeowners, one mortgage data company says 4.3 million Americans missed their mortgage payments in May. That's up from 2 million at the end of March. Derek Thompson is a staff writer at The Atlantic, covering economics, technology, and the media. He's also the author of Hitmakers, The Science of Popularity in an Age of Distraction, and host of the Crazy Genius podcast. Derek, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you so much.
You write in your piece on this, Derek, that COVID didn't necessarily just cause a housing crisis. It escalated one that was already brewing. Can you talk about pre-COVID, what we saw when it came to housing?
Pre-COVID, what we saw when it came to housing is that we're not building enough houses. And when I say houses, I mean single-family houses, like, you know, houses with lawns. And I mean multifamily houses, like apartment buildings and condo buildings. We just weren't building enough. And it's somewhat ironic, you could say, because one of the issues that we had in 2006 to 2008 during the housing crash that gave us the Great Recession, that was partly because we had sort of, you know, there were too many houses that went on the market. People felt like we had overbuilt in the previous decade. Well, in the last decade, we've underbuilt. And as a result, you know, supply and demand, when the supply is constricted, prices go up. And so, rental prices went up for a lot of people, went up for a lot of low-income Americans who found themselves more stretched to afford the rent. And so we had a slow-motion housing crisis to that extent happening before the pandemic. And what's happened now, obviously, is that tens of millions of people have lost their jobs. They have had their income supplemented by the federal government in terms of its unemployment insurance, the $600 per week bump up. They've gotten their $1,200 checks. But now all of that cash that came with the CARES Act passed in March, it's coming up against a cliff. And Congress has not authorized a new CARES Act, new spending to help people afford to stay in their homes. And that as a result means that we seem to be on the edge of an eviction cliff. So you put it all together, you had 10 years of not building enough houses, you had a pandemic, and now you have a Congress that is dithering when it needs to be helping Americans afford the rent that is already too high.
On top of that, Cliff, there's also the notion that we had these moratoria on evictions, either and some mortgage forgiveness for federally backed mortgages, the rental and eviction moratorium for federally subsidized housing, and also state level moratoriums on evictions. Those are coming to an end, too, right over the next few months.
That's right. There's a money half of this equation and there's a rules half of this equation, or a law half of this equation. So the money half is pretty simple to state, maybe hard to do in practice. We need to find ways to give people more money or continue to give them money so that they can continue to afford to pay the rent, even if their jobs don't immediately come back in the pandemic. And then on the rules and the law side, we need to extend a lot of eviction moratoriums, or moratoria, I guess would be the Latinate plural. We need to do it now. You know, this is not something where you can afford to be a little bit late. People can be kicked out of their apartments, and homelessness is an absolute human tragedy. And it's inexcusable in a country that has access to so much money and so much wealth that we have the homelessness crisis that we already have. Exacerbating it is unacceptable. You want to both extend the cash side of this and the legal side of it as well.
And let's talk about who this is hitting. You wrote in your piece that lower income people in particular were paying things like, you know, 20-30% of their income just on their housing costs, their rent or maybe mortgage. And in many cases, they are the people who are likely to lose their jobs.
Yeah, that's exactly it. There was a study, I believe, from the Furman Center that essentially looked at this question in New York City specifically and found that the households who are most likely to face what they called a, quote, economic disruption, losing a job, having your hours cut back, were the most likely to have spent the highest share of their income on housing. So the people who were most housing burdened were also those who were most pandemic burdened. It's a double whammy. And look, it's just the responsibility of a wealthy country and a progressive government to look out for those who are most disadvantaged. And that right now is people who might be low income to begin with, might have less of an education to begin with, are in the face-to-face economy. They work in retail. They work in restaurants. They work at bars. They work in industries that in much of the country either aren't allowed by local ordinance or frankly shouldn't be allowed by local ordinance. I don't know exactly what percent of America is allowing people to crowd in indoor bars, but that should be absolutely illegal. It should not be allowed. That is a petri dish for the spread of COVID-19. So for a variety of, complex reasons, you have, as you alluded to, this sad scenario where the people who are most rent burdened are also those who are in the crosshairs of the pandemic.
We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic. We're talking about a looming housing crisis. He says in the United States, people hit by COVID having trouble making rent, paying mortgages, eviction moratoria coming to an end around the country, and the risk of a lot of people being put out of their housing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had trouble, especially in the last couple of months, making that mortgage payment, that rent payment? Are you a landlord? Are you seeing your tenants having trouble making their payments? How's that affecting you? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Derek, this is could be a trickle-up problem. Those landlords I mentioned, they're not going to be able to make their payments. Banks might be hit by this. This is a problem that ultimately wouldn't just affect the people who are having trouble paying for their housing in the first place, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. One way that I think about it is that you have a health crisis that is becoming an economic crisis, has become an economic crisis, and an economic crisis can become a financial crisis. And that's what you really, look, you don't want any of this. You don't want a health crisis. You don't want an economic crisis, but we definitely don't want it to spiral into a financial crisis, which will make the economic crisis work. And when I say a financial crisis, I mean, I'm talking about not just the level of workers and people paying rent, paying mortgages, on their homes, but also talking about the banks and the landlords and the companies that have bonds and their own obligations that could go that could become imperiled if you essentially have people not paying rent. If you can sort of knock down the dominoes one by one. If individuals can't pay rent, then the landlords aren't getting rent. If the landlords aren't getting rent, then in the short term, maybe they'll decide we're not going to pay for upkeep for this apartment. So the apartment is going to, it'll stink. They won't take out the trash. Things that are broken will stay broken. And then the medium term, a month or two later, those landlords might eventually realize that they can't pay their mortgages. They can't pay their own obligations. And so what happens is that they'll essentially be in foreclosure with their bank. The bank will take over the apartment. Maybe they'll cut off the lease agreements that they have with the current people who live in that apartment because they want to do various things that the pre-existing landowner didn't want to do, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you can see how this just spirals and becomes more of a disaster. You don't want it to spiral. You want to solve the problem now. And that problem can be solved with extending the CARES Act, and also by extending a lot of these eviction moratoria.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Brad is with us in Port Washington. Brad, hi.
How are you guys doing today?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Brad?
Well, I am actually one of those low-income people that you are talking about. Actually, my low-income residence is Saukville. And it's even more dire than people would think, as well as the 30% rent, which basically almost puts me at about fair market value for this. I've also noticed that, and not just me, but, other low-income properties and whatnot that I've, talked with people about, they're not exactly upkept as far as drafts and things like that. So come wintertime, my heating bill is about $300 a month, and energy assistance gives me $700 for the entire season. Mind you, I've got two kids. So if my fair market value is roughly $825, I probably pay about $795 for the 30% of my income. You add another $300 for heat. That leaves me about $900 for 4 weeks to feed my family, do the gas, and any other bills that may happen. God forbid I have a tire that decides to blow out.
Brad, thank you so much for sharing that story, and good luck to you. Derek, precarious is the word that pops into my head there. If everything goes perfectly for Brad, it's tough, but he can make it, but there's not a lot of wiggle room there.
Absolutely. I mean, he's describing a situation where he has $225 every week to spend on food and necessities. I mean, it's inexcusable, and it's inexcusable in all sorts of ways that should be fixed under an administration that knows what it's doing. And I hope that it is fixed with expanded welfare laws and universal health insurance laws. In the meantime, we're not going to be able to overhaul, you know, welfare in the next month under this administration and with this Senate. And so what we can ask them to do, what we can demand that they do, is do what they did in March, pass a law that allows for $1,000 to be delivered, $1,200 to be delivered to Mark's household. If he loses his job, to have unemployment insurance that has a $600 per week bump up that makes sure that he has more money to pay for his family, to pay for his food, to pay for his rent and everything else that he needs, including that tire. What we can do right now, it seems very obvious to me, but we're coming up very, very close to this eviction cliff. We're coming very, very close to August, where the law essentially expires, especially when it comes to unemployment insurance. It's unacceptable, and we just have to extend it.
We're talking about America's looming potential housing crisis with Derek Thompson of The Atlantic, the problems and possible solutions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have you had trouble paying your rent, mortgage, or utilities during the pandemic? Are you or somebody you know facing eviction? Do you want to see action from the federal government, another round of relief from the damage to the economy from COVID-19? What would you want that to look like, if anything? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion about America's potential housing crisis accelerated by the coronavirus. Our guest says the housing problem has been years in the making. It's now dangerously close to spiraling out of control. Derek Thompson stays with us. He writes about economics, technology, and the media at The Atlantic. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about losing your home? How has COVID-19 changed your financial situation, if at all? Are there policies or programs you would like to see from the state, from the federal government? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Robert is with us in Toma. Robert, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Robert?
I'm Toma calling again. Where's this money going to come from? We can't give people free money again. They have to go get a job, whether they like it or not. Mow the grass, babysit. It's all this privilege and stuff.
Robert, thanks for the call. Robert's saying there's not money really out there for the federal government, and people need to work harder to find jobs to deal with the situation, Derek.
Yeah, I disagree with Robert. I guess I disagree in at least two ways. First off, I'm not that concerned about where the money is going to come from. The reason to be concerned about a high deficit or large debt burden is that you fear you're going to you're going to crowd out investments. That's not really in danger of happening because the economy is on death's door right now. And also you're afraid about inflation, and inflation is really nowhere to be seen. So I'm not particularly concerned about deficits. I'm not concerned about the debt. I am concerned about people's ability, like Mark, to pay for rent and pay for food and pay for his kids and make sure that his car is still working. That's a far more urgent concern than inflation or any crowding out effect from deficit financed spending by the federal government. The other thing is that I don't think it is the case. The people who aren't working right now are not working because of laziness or because of privilege. I think the vast majority of people between 18 and 65 right now who are not working, I'll bet they want to work. I'll bet a lot of them want to work desperately. I'll bet a lot of them are looking for work every single day. And that is, I know, just an exhausting process and an existentially painful process to apply to job after job and recognize and feel like no one's listening to you. I mean, there's a lot of pain there, and it is pain and not privilege that I think defines the experience of the unemployed in America today. And so I think that we should absolutely deal with them with care, deal with them with grace and generosity, and continue to deficit finance the money that we are using to give them as they are prevented from working by a once in a century pandemic.
Thanks for that call, Robert. We'll go to Tanner now in Madison. Tanner, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? I just have a comment that I would like, you know, and kind of a question. You know, the government, the federal government, they're obviously not doing enough. We spend billions and billions of dollars on, you know, our military, new jets and tanks and all of that. If they could decide, oh, let's not buy 10 tanks and let's send all this few billion dollars back like a stimulus check like they have, why is that such a big deal for them? You know, and it's really not. I know it's not. You know, they have billions and billions of dollars.
Tanner, thanks a lot for the call. Tanner's saying not so much deficit funding, this kind of spending, Derek, but to reprioritize spending from the military.
Yeah, this is a look. I am if I were an advisor to an administration, and they asked how we could reimagine the federal budget, which is a $4 trillion, I guess maybe this year $5-7 trillion. Thing, I would definitely look at the possibility of reducing some military spending. We spend an extraordinary amount of money on the military, and some of it I think is very useful and necessary, and a lot of it I think is fantastically wasteful. At the same time, we don't need right now to think about this in a zero-sum way. We don't need to think of it as in order to have another $1 trillion bill to help the unemployed, we need to take that trillion from the military over the next decade. We don't have to think that way at all. We can just spend the money. If we have an issue with inflation going forward, that will likely, in many cases, mean that we got out of these doldrums of deflation that define the economic crisis. It'll be a possibly good thing. And frankly, we haven't had hyperinflation in this country I suppose we had inflation a little bit in the late 1980s, early 1990s, nothing like the 1970s, obviously, since the 1970s, that's 45 years. There's really no country in the developed world that's dealing with inflation. So I don't want to go on a whole thing about inflation, but the reason I go through that is to say, you know, the reason to think, oh no, we have to cut things in order to give the unemployed money. The only reason to think that is because you're living in a zero-sum mindset. And I'm saying we don't have to live in that mindset. We can run a huge, huge, huge deficit right now and not worry about it because of the macroeconomic conditions of the world.
Thanks for the call. We're talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic about a potential looming housing crisis. We'll go back to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, I have a question. When you look at the history of this, President Bush gave us all $300, and Obama propped up the banks in the crisis of 2008. And when I ran for political office in 2008, I knew that there was going to be government money invested in private companies, and my Democratic opponent disagreed with that. But that's essentially what the government is doing, and they got their money back, you know. But what I'm wondering is, because the government is now giving us $1,200 stimulus checks and maybe it'll be 2,000. I mean, isn't it essentially, aren't we just becoming more dependent on government instead of becoming more independent as private citizens?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff worried about us being too dependent on government checks.
Yeah, we are absolutely dependent on government right now, but we're dependent on government not because of any lack of rugged individualism. We're dependent on government because a pandemic that is a once-in-a-century outbreak is destroying communities and killing something like 800, 900 people every single day. And hundreds of thousands of people are becoming infected by this disease every single week right now. The pandemic is the economy in many ways. Where you have surges of the pandemic, you have the economy fall off a cliff. And we have to solve that health crisis. And you can't really solve a public health crisis as an individual. You can't really take it upon yourself to solve a public health crisis as a private individual. And so right now, we need government. We need government to step up across the board. We need guidance and clear communication from the federal government. We need testing apparatuses and tracing and isolation strategies that are guided by the CDC and the federal government. We need state governors to step up and say, people need to wear masks outside and inside. We need, you know, local governments and mayors and council members to understand their own local crises, because at the end of the day, this is a local disease. It's a local phenomenon, and make the appropriate rules to open and close various establishments as necessary. But, you know, without getting into a whole thing about, you know, Ayn Rand and rugged individualism versus progressive government, you know, right now we absolutely need governments to step up. We also need individuals to step up. We need individuals to recognize that they are not islands in the ocean. They are a part of a chain of transmission. And if they get sick, even if they feel like they can fight it, they might pass this disease along to 15 other people, some of whom might die. And so we need to think of ourselves as living socially, not socialistly necessarily, but socially, that our actions right now are exquisitely bound up in the fates of other people. And if we get sick and we come home to our families, you know, we can get all sorts of other people sick as well. So I would encourage people to be responsible and take, you know, individual responsibility seriously, but also recognize that there is a huge role for government to play in making sure that we collectively act to fight this disease.
We'll leave it there. Derek, thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That's Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, looking at a possible housing crisis amid the pandemic and how he says Congress could help solve it.